they're in the driver's seat in the sense that you can't get to any deal without including them.
The power of the Musk-Ox Coalition as the legislature's special session drags on. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, at the start of a long holiday weekend, fire managers are on high alert.
It doesn't take long for what rain we've had to dry out and those fuels become dry again and are receptive to any kind of ignition source.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
The legislature is on day 126 of what was supposed to be a 90-day session, and many Alaskans are wondering what's taking so long. Lawmakers still have to pass a budget for the coming year and figure out how to fund it. But Democrats have made it clear they won't vote for a budget unless the legislature reforms the state's oil tax system. And on that front, they've been joined by some Republicans. How well that coalition hangs together may decide how things shake out in Juneau. APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
As House Speaker Mike Chenault will tell you, there is just one problem in Juneau. And it's a math problem.
We're still here because we haven't put together a budget that we can get 30 members to agree to. That's why we're still here.
30 members is three quarters of the House. That's what Chenault, a Nikiski Republican, needs in order to pull money from the state's traditional rainy day fund, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, to cover the shortfall in next year's budget. Chenault only has 26 members in his majority, so he needs the support of House Democrats. And whatever they agree to also has to pass muster with Republicans in the Senate. Getting those three factions to agree is hard enough. But Chenault is also facing divisions within his own caucus. Those divisions became crystal clear on one vote this month. Oil taxes.
25 yeas, 12 nays.
So the vote of 25 yeas, 12 nays. Second committee substitute for House Bill 247, rules amended on the floor, has passed the House.
Several members of Chenault's House majority joined with Democrats to pass a sweeping overhaul of the state's oil tax system over the objections of the Republican leadership. Paul Seaton, a Homer Republican, brokered the deal in the House.
Oil tax credits are one of the largest expenditures in our state, and if you don't control those expenditures, I don't see how that's fiscally conservative to say that we can cut K-12 education, but we're going to continue oil tax credits on the North Slope at the rate we are.
Seaton and others have been called the Musk-Ox Coalition, a name coined by Palmer Republican Jim Colver after the same group circled up to oppose using permanent fund earnings in last year's budget battles. It also includes Republicans Louise Stutes and Gabrielle Ledoux, and rural Democrats Neil Foster and Bryce Edgeman, who normally caucus with the Republicans. Throw in Juneau's Kathy Munoz and call them the Musk-Ox Coalition, or members of the Bush Caucus or Coastal Caucus, as they've been called in the past, or just plain moderates. Right now, they're essential for just about any deal, especially on oil taxes.
They're in the driver's seat in the sense that you can't get to any deal without including them.
Jim Lotzfeldt is a lobbyist, political operative, and longtime legislative watcher. He says the majority has always had divisions. When the state was flush with money, leadership could paper over some of those differences by doling out funds for projects back home. But with this year's meager capital budget, that's no longer an option. Plus, the issues on the table are important enough that core philosophical differences are asserting themselves. Their key role has made the Musk-Ox into targets. Suzanne Downing, the communications director for the state GOP, called out the lawmakers by name in her newsletter as the special session began. Louise Stutes of Kodiak says that's not helpful.
I feel like we're kind of being targeted because we're trying to work together as a group of legislators. And for the Republican Party to target us when we're trying to do the job, that we're sent down here to do, and that means working with everyone that's here, not just working with Republicans.
Lotzfeldt says in the past, someone has usually stepped forward with a strategy to close out the legislature, whether it's leadership in the House or Senate or the governor. But so far, nobody has taken the reins. And ultimately, he says, it's not unexpected that lawmakers are having trouble getting out of Juneau this year.
Let's say oil tax credit was the only issue the legislature was dealing with. Well, they would still be wrapped around the axle because it's a tough issue. But not only are they dealing with that tough issue, they're dealing with, you know, income taxes, an idea, changing the permanent fund, drastically reducing the state budget. So there's just so many big issues right now that it's no surprise that it's such a cluster.
Lawmakers have until June 1st before state workers will receive layoff warning notices. If there's no budget by July 1st, the state could face a government shutdown. Reporting from Juneau, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
Attorneys for the two defendants, Greg Immig and Amy DeWitt, in the Sockeye fire case, have asked for more time from the court to prepare a case for trial. Today, Judge David Zwink granted their request from the bench in Palmer. According to attorney Kevin Fitzgerald, who represents Greg Immig, the state has made an offer. But Palmer District Attorney Roman Kolacek would not comment on what that offer might be. Kolacek says he is reluctant to discuss details of the case, but if the state is to resolve it, there would have to be an acceptance of criminal negligence and restitution on the part of the defendants. The next pretrial hearing is scheduled for June 10th. Almost a year to the day of the start of the Sockeye fire. The hot, dry conditions in South Central and Interior Alaska has fire officials worried. Alaskans will be headed outdoors to enjoy the Memorial Day weekend, the unofficial start of summer for many. But fire managers are reminding state residents that the risk of wildfire is extremely high, and they are urging caution. State Fire Information Officer Tim Mowry says even though some areas have received some rainfall and cooler weather, it's been spotty.
It doesn't take long for what rain we've had to dry out, and those fuels, you know, become dry again and are receptive to any kind of ignition source.
There have already been about 150 wildfires reported in Alaska this year, most of them human-caused. One of those fires was a two-acre blaze in Anchorage, which Mowry says highlights an issue of growing concern among fire managers. Drones. Mowry says drones impact aviation similarly to birds. They are small, move unpredictably, fly at lower altitudes where firefighting aircraft operate, and he says they can potentially bring down helicopters and planes. Mowry says federal safety protocols, which the state follows, say if a drone is spotted in the area, all firefighting air operations must cease until it's confirmed the drone is no longer in the airspace.
So that means if we've got helicopters responding to a fire to drop water on a fire, or we've got air retardant tankers coming in to drop a retardant, and they can't operate because there's a drone in the airspace, that means that fire gets bigger, that fire threatens homes, property, lives.
Mowry says time is critical in the initial attack on a fire. With low humidity and temperatures predicted to hit the mid-70s throughout much of South Central Alaska and the Kenai Peninsula over the weekend, Mowry says fire conditions could worsen.
People still need to be vigilant and, use caution with anything that can start a wildfire.
Burn bans are currently in effect in Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna Valley, but could change over the weekend. Go to alaskapublic.org for more information. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, understanding the history of fishery permits.
We got to hear lots of great stories about people moving up from volcanic eruptions and flu epidemics. Like, we're going way, way back with some of these original permit holders.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence,
and by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska Congressman Don Young will have a say in drafting the final version of Senator Lisa Murkowski's energy modernization bill. That's because the U.S. House passed its own energy bill this week to match the Murkowski bill already passed in the Senate. House leaders then picked Young to serve on the conference committee that will negotiate a compromise between the two bills.
I'm very happy to be on a conference bill. It is really a big thing, as you think. Lisa's going to be, Senator Murkowski's going to be the chairman. And I'll be on the conference, and it gives us sort of a double whammy concerning Alaska.
There are big differences between the bills. Murkowski's bill is a mix of priorities from the left and right. It promotes both renewables and fossil fuels. The House bill is more Republican. Young says his top priority will be to ensure the final bill includes his Native American Energy Act. Young says it will allow tribes and Alaska Native corporations to cut red tape so they can produce more energy on their own lands.
It doesn't mean there's going to be any more environmental damage or anything. It's going to be, in fact, they don't have to wait for permits.
The White House, though, says Young's bill would undermine environmental protection and set unreasonable regulatory deadlines. It threatened a veto a few months ago when the House passed it as a standalone. Young says a big point of contention will be the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Murkowski's energy bill would remove the expiration date of the fund, which was a key selling point for Democrats. The fund uses offshore oil revenues to protect land, often by buying it. Young says the government already owns too much land, so he sides with House leaders who want to require congressional approval to buy more. When permits for the Bristol Bay salmon fishery became limited, about half the permits were issued to watershed residents. In the decades since, some have stayed with residents and others have left. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more on one effort to better understand the forces at play.
University of Washington researcher Jennifer Meredith came to Bristol Bay this spring to study permits in the salmon fishery. After seeing 10 communities and talking to hundreds of residents, she's learned a couple of things.
I do think the thing that all the places have in common is people are really committed to the salmon fishery. And there's a lot of really tragic stories of the way that the permit system affected people out here. But there's a lot of really empowering stories, families that have been fishing for 12 generations now, you know, that rely on the resource and intend to bequeath their permit to their descendants who can continue to rely on the resource.
Meredith and her team of research assistants have visited Aleknagik, New Halen, Iliamna, Togiak, Naknek, King Salmon, South Naknek, Koliganik, and Manakotik. In each town, Meredith and her colleagues set out to find what happened to randomly selected permit holders. Different strategies worked best in different communities. The team tried several ways to get answers. They hired locals to help understand the community and family trees, and offered Subway sandwiches, coffee cards, a fuel raffle to get respondents to show up. And then they interviewed permit holders or people who knew permit holders and heard many, many stories.
That's really the way that we start every survey is, where are you from? Where was your family from? What brought them here? So we got to hear lots of great stories about people moving up from volcanic eruptions and flu epidemics. Like, we're going way, way back with some of these original permit holders and hearing about the original founders and pioneers, and then a lot of the history of the Native peoples and where they located and what brought them into settlements and that kind of thing.
They found a long list of factors that play into the decision to fish a permit or sell it: markets and processors and price, access to other support resources like CDQ programs, even whether the permit holder had family members to pass it on to.
You know, there are people that sold permits and invested the money into a different type of enterprise. And there are people that sold permits because they really felt like they had to pay their bills and they got in a tough spot. There's all different reasons. I wouldn't say there's one thread, but I'm looking forward to analyzing the data and seeing what we find.
And they found that some communities actually haven't lost permits.
We were up in Koliganik and very, very few permits have been sold out of there. So it was important to us to have a variety of situations. And there's definitely a misconception, I would say, on the part of people down here closer to the bay that the people from up in Lake District have sold more permits than them. But in terms of actual numbers, it's pretty equivalent.
Meredith is an economist.
and she's hoping to turn all those stories into a robust picture of why people keep permits, why they sell them, and what happens in either case. The perception I've come away with is there's five sides to every coin. I'm interested to see what comes out of the data as far as what policies might help moving forward. And I'm hopeful that we get some real rigorous results using all these control groups for what happens when a permit is sold, as far as what are the consequences for the descendants in terms of where they live, what their occupation is, and what their assets look like later on. Getting that analysis will start with a lot of data entry. But first, the team is still hoping to track down a few more permit holders. So far, they've surveyed about 700 of the 1,000 randomly selected permit holders and are hoping to connect with another 150 in Dillingham. And when the data entry is done and the results are in, Meredith hopes to present it all back in Dillingham. I'm Molly Dishner.
As another barge season in the interior gets into full swing, there is one less Nenana-based company offering services. Ruby Marine has purchased Inland Barge Service for an undisclosed amount and incorporated the equipment and staff of Inland into its fleet. Longtime Inland Barge owner and captain Charlie Nilica calls the deal a win-win, which began with a phone call earlier this year from Ruby Marine president Matt Sweetser, who was concerned about a potential staffing problem at Ruby Marine.
His crew is aging. It's time to kind of get a better pool of workers, or more of a pool of workers, so that you can start filling spaces as people retire or move on. The kind of work we do is so singular that you just can't find somebody with a license to kind of fill those spots. I mean, it's a long apprenticeship program, really, to be of any value. Realizing that, he approached me this past spring about being bought by Ruby Marine.
Inland Barge has already shut down its facility at the end of Front Street in Nenana and merged its office operations and equipment with those of Ruby Marine at mile 306 of the Parks Highway on the north side of the Tanana River. Nilica says Ruby Marine will continue to offer the same services to customers that Inland Barge did, and while the companies have had a freight-sharing arrangement since Ruby Marine started in 2007, the financial implications of passing freight to someone else are now removed.
Just be a little more flexibility now. I don't have to worry about every ounce I'm putting on my deck to pay my crew and satisfy my bills. Now everything is being pooled, so it'll make it a lot easier to divvy up the freight. If Matt's going someplace before I'm going there, he can take something or some of the bigger pieces that work better with his equipment.
Nilica acquired Inland Barge in 1994 from original owners Claude Dementive and family. Inland's familiar tugboat, the Ramona, has been running the Yukon and other interior rivers since 1971.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, BioBlitz. Last week, a group of scientists traveled to a small village in the Arctic to find as many different species as they could. It was happening all over the country in celebration of the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. But as KUAC's Molly Reddick reports, it had a special meaning in Anaktuvik Pass, where the local Inupiaq people live a subsistence lifestyle inside of a national park.
It was warm and sunny when we left Anaktuvik Pass early in the morning. We headed toward Blueberry Hill, walking through soggy tundra and patches of snow. Soon the village disappeared, and we were surrounded by an amphitheater of mountains. Suddenly, there was something fluttering around our feet.
No! We need that. Oh, I don't have a net. Oh my gosh.
Kendall Hildebrandt lunged after a small flying creature.
I hope I got it. Did I get it? Oh, it's right there. Right there.
She cupped her hands over a patch of tundra and peeked underneath.
Yes.
It was a brown butterfly, an exciting catch, even though she was actually looking for voles. She had set over 100 mouse traps in 2 days, smearing them with peanut butter and setting them near the openings of small holes in the tundra.
It's the Snickers bars of the animal kingdom, so everybody eats them.
So if there's a lot of voles, then...
You know, there's going to be a lot of happy eagles and a lot of happy foxes.
Hildebrandt is a small mammal researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Museum. She's one of 25 scientists and volunteers trying to find as many living things as they can in the dirt, mountains, and ponds around town.
Vole, Wilson's warbler, raven, savanna, sparrow.
Jeff Rasick works for Gates of the Arctic National Park. He organized the event to get a snapshot of what's happening in the Arctic and to get the community involved in science. It's called a BioBlitz.
It's a scavenger hunt, yeah. Let's tally up as many living things as we can in a short amount of time. Birds, plants, small mammals, large mammals if we happen to see them.
While spring is well underway in most of the country, it's a little early in the Arctic, so the species tended to be pretty small.
Slimy sculpin, dicots, wolf spiders.
After tramping through the park with nets, Ziploc bags, and binoculars, scientists returned to the Nunamute School with backpacks full of samples. They set up tables in the gym and covered them with fox skulls, bird wings, and various types of scat. The brown butterfly we had found on the hillside was now flattened onto a square of wax paper. Catherine Daly studies insects at the UAF Museum. She was straightening out the wings, which had orange spots along the outer edges.
The genus Erebia was documented here in the 70s, so it's great to know that it's still here.
The local people have a different name for it.
I was talking to an elder last night who said, oh, the chocolate butterflies, that's what you caught. And I said, yes, chocolate butterflies.
There were little scientists helping out too. Kids ran around the yard with nets searching for bugs and took turns looking through the microscope.
Is this a bumblebee?
No, that's a yellow jacket.
It looks like little...
It's a type of wasp.
Can I move closer in?
7-year-old Anna Napukiguk has long dark hair and is wearing a blue t-shirt with a butterfly on it. She says bugs are her favorite part of the BioBlitz. She's learned a lot about nature from her elders, especially when her family goes camping in the summer.
They like teach us how bugs live and they teach us a lot of stuff in your pack about cutting squirrels. Don't eat that, don't eat them, because we only use the skin to make a tikaluk. Parkas.
Animals are the basis of life in Anaktuvuk Pass. Far away from roads or supermarkets, most of the people living here hunt for their food. One animal in particular, the caribou.
We live with it every day. I don't care if it was for breakfast.
Vera Woods is curator at the Anaktuvuk Pass Museum and a hunter.
I like it frozen, raw. And it warms you up in the body because it's cooking in your stomach and keep you warm all day.
The Western Arctic caribou have traditionally migrated right through the village on their way to the coast. But the past few years, the herd has been shrinking and moving farther away. It's been hard for hunters, but they're finding ways to adapt. Woods says locals can learn from scientists about things like animal population and water quality, and they're sharing their knowledge as well.
We're teaching them how we live here, and they're valuing us, our ways of life, how we survive and live here in the mountains, in the park.
By Sunday, the BioBlitzers had found over 100 species and counting.
Whoa!
It looks like a little fuzzy Christmas tree.
As locals headed up the valley looking for caribou, 3 scientists hunted for plants north of town.
Like the things on the side?
Down on the tundra, you could tell summer was near. For AK, I'm Molly Redig.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Brett Connor of Anchorage. Connor is a born and raised Alaskan, and he designs and sells his own clothing line called Hewlin Alaska Design.
When I was a kid, actually, honestly, what I wanted to do was leave Alaska. Because it just, you know, as a kid, you want more. I wanted to live like the biggest city I could. I remember it was sometime because I just hadn't experienced that. And now I feel like being in Anchorage really is, you're not really in Alaska like most people say, but for me it's perfect because I really like how we're getting more and more and more of this sort of a city feeling to it, which I do, I like that. And at the same time, we're so close to everything else that we've got. I grew up on the upper hillside area, and I'd end up going home almost every afternoon with my really good friends, and they lived way up there on the residential part by Flat Top. So we'd just go up there all afternoon and just snowboard out in the you know, hiking kind of backcountry and building a jump or whatever, just kids playing around doing whatever. And then the evening time comes, and I'd just be like, well, time to go home. Instead of like getting a ride, or I didn't yet have a car or anything, I was just like, well, just hike like one little peak back, ride down the backside of the Flat Top little valley, end up on Canyon Road, and then ride down that down Upper Yarmouth, and basically snowboard home. And back then it just seemed normal, but now, you know, now I look back and I'm like, man, that was pretty cool. I get to just like, you know, use my snowboard as a means of transportation. It's pretty cool. Now with the family and like our little daughter who's like turning 4 in a month. Now we've kind of altered all those activities to be all inclusive for all of us. So it's like turns into kind of like hiking with the baby backpack on the Winter Creek Trail in Girdwood, or like taking the mountain bike with the chariot kind of hookup thing to tow the little one out on the coastal trail, and you know, things like that. Or I get to take an afternoon run up Flat Top, and so really that's kind of the thing now.
Brett Connor lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Molly Reddig and Ammon Swenson. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Josh Edge in Anchorage, Molly Dishner in Dillingham, and Tim Bodoni in Galena. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.